as most of you know, there was a in September there was a peace agreement signed in South Sudan. It was a big step forward. It was helped facilitated by IGAD, the East African collection of countries, and but particularly pushed through or by Sudan in Khartoum. A lot of the discussions happened in Khartoum. Since that time, there's been a number of positive things that have happened. Right now, as we speak, opposition members who were once at war are now in Juba and are participating in the peace process, and it's moving forward. They work moving around without any problems from the government or whatever. Secondly, what we have seen is 16 or 17 peace meetings that have occurred across the country. Many of these have been facilitated by UNMISS and brought opposition and, again, government figures together and their armed forces together, and they've had discussions and it's been done amicably. Third, the amount of fighting in the country has diminished greatly, or political fighting has gone is diminished greatly. There's still cattle rustling and people being killed through that sort of ethnic violence, but political violence has dropped dramatically, with the exception of the south of South Sudan and the Equatorias, where Thomas Cirillo's groupings have been in conflict with the SSPDF, the South Sudan Development Forces, Defence Forces. And lastly, and I think quite positively, is we're seeing a number of people in the protection of civilian sites and across the country as well expressing a desire to go back to their homes. And so, in effect, the peace agreement and the success of the peace agreement will be in some ways measured by the way that these people go back. So in approximate terms, there's about 130,000 people come back from neighbouring countries. And as I say, within the POCs, people are starting to move out or requesting assistance to be able to move back to their homes. On the other sort of slightly less positive side, I think we still have concerns that the momentum of the peace agreement and the peace talks might slow. Some of the meetings that have been going on have lacked some substance, and there's been a lack of real outcomes. A lot of process has been discussed, but a lot of the outcomes are still to be sorted out. So we need to be able to help and get behind that. That's part of my discussions with member states of the Security Council in particular over to today and yesterday. Has been and tomorrow will be the discussions around having then moving forward with that. So in general, it's important that we speak as one voice. We get in behind the peace process. There's only one peace process in town. It's this one, and that we are able. We focus on trying to maintain that momentum and move the process forward. If we can do that, then I think South Sudan stands a real chance of moving forward. If I look back 4 months ago or 5 months ago, I would have said the chances of being where we are today was unlikely, and we're here. And what I'd like to be able to think that in 5 months from now, we will be at a better and different place than we are now along a positive road. So let me stop there and please, very happy to take your questions.
James?
James Bayes from Al Jazeera. First, I mean, you present a pretty positive picture, but in terms of the stages of things that's supposed to happen, there was that word cantonment of the forces. What's going on with the various forces from the opposition and from the government side, and also going forward about trying to share power and agreeing who gets what in terms of ministries and everything else, and going forward then the return of Machar, when is that taking place? If you give us some idea on that, and then a second question, if you don't mind, is there an impact in South Sudan of the protests in Sudan on the economy, on the UN's logistics, on oil money? I mean, is what's happening in Sudan affecting South Sudan in any way?
Okay. Just on the, there are a number of the most complicated issues that you've just mentioned. The cantonment, it's less of, I think of it less about cantonment and more about a shared vision of where the security forces are going to be and how they're going to come together. So the cantonment is one part of that process, but it's also about security sector reform, how the Mashar forces and the Kiev forces and others come together. That's still being worked out. And we have been told by the South Sudanese that a plan will be produced later this week, so we're looking forward to seeing that. On some of the other issues in terms of portfolios, that's still to be worked out between the, particularly with the South Sudanese Opposition Alliance, the alliance of the non-Riek Machar groupings, deciding exactly who's going to be their vice president candidate is going to be important. There has been some good steps in that what we call the former detainees, the senior group of people who were detained in 2013, they have publicly joined the government, so in terms of pledged support to the government and the way forward, so that's at least a step in the right direction. When it comes to Machar coming back, I was in Sudan and Khartoum last week, speaking to the Sudanese government, but also to Riek Machar. I had a long chat with him. He told me that he's committed to coming back at the end of May. That's the end of the pre-transitional period, and that's the critical juncture in terms of going from where we are now in this pre-transitional period and going through into the transitional period that will ultimately lead to elections. He even said that he was not going to be insisting that everything was in place. He felt that, you know, if it looked like it was there was good momentum going forward, that he wanted to come back. So I took him at his word, and I think that's positive. If certainly his wife and his number two in South Sudan right now as we speak. So obviously reporting back to him about the situation on the ground. In relation to Sudan, there hasn't been any appreciable difference that we've noticed with the issues in Sudan. I spoke about it to the Sudanese when I was there. We are keen that the Sudanese stay engaged. They did a very good job in bringing the peace process to where it is today. And so if they are able to stay engaged, I think it's important for the peace process for them to be in that engagement and with the other members of IGAD as well with them. That worked successfully, as I say, last year, and we would hope that it would continue.
Bay, and then Carol.
The U.S. Treasury recently sanctioned three people for dealing arms in South Sudan, including two local partner of an Israeli guy named Israel Zeev. Do you know anything about that? And also, since the UN is investigating it through the Michael Gibb Commission, can you tell us if he is on their target list?
The only information I have on Israel Zeev is exactly what you have. We haven't had any other information in South Sudan on that. Clearly, there's both an arms embargo and sanctions in place now, but we don't have any. We don't get involved with it, and we don't follow it in any great extent.
Are you aware of the Michael Gibb investigation?
Not really, no.
Carol.
Mr. Chair, I'm Carol Landry with Agence France-Presse. The Secretary-General had planned a trip to South Sudan, and it looks like it's not going to happen. Can you tell us a bit why that is and when he might be visiting?
He was, as I understand it, looking to add that to the when he was in the summit in Addis. But he's decided not to. I think I had discussions with him last week. I think there's a good time for him to come. Right now, we only have one. We still don't have Riek Machar in Juba, but it comes to the end of that pre-transitional period, the beginning of the transitional period, which is going to be critical. If the two of them are able to be back in South Sudan, those two leaders, it might be a more important time for him to be there then, but not now.
Great. Any other questions? Great. Oh, go ahead.
Carol.
We're not begging.
Five more questions.
That's right.
Can you just go over the figures on the protection of civilian sites? How many are there now? How many do you think, you're saying people are talking about returning home. So how many do you think might leave those sites?
We have about 193,000 in the sites at the moment. So that's down from approximately 205,000 five months ago. Certainly in Wau, where there were 39,000 there, it's down to 14 now. Our intention surveys suggest another about 40% of those people who are remaining will leave. And in Juba, our intention survey suggests that of the 32,000 that are in Juba, 40% of them will leave, and most of them want to go back to their homes, their original homes. So we're seeing that as an indicator. We're certainly not closing PSCs. We're certainly not pushing people out. But if people want to leave voluntarily and they feel that they would like to go back to their homes, it's incumbent on us to make sure that we can do everything to help them to be able to do that. And that includes getting our peacekeeping forces more out into the areas where they are going to return to now during the dry season, so that there's a greater degree of confidence for people to go back to. Yeah. You're hogging the limelight. Yeah.
Okay, sorry. The last time that Riek Machar returned to Juba, as you know, it was disastrous. What has changed in that tandem that now they can work together, they can govern together?
It's a good question. I mean, I think in 2015 it was certainly a different scenario. The agreement that came about was there was some, both sides were had some reservations about what they had signed up to, so they weren't particularly happy with it. I think the situation on the ground has changed in terms of the government is in control of a large area of territory now. But I think there's certainly from people in South Sudan an enormous push for peace, and I don't think either side can turn their back on that. And together with the way that the peace negotiations were conducted, it brought both sides together, and they were able to list out and be able to agree on the basic framework for going forward. Now there are some tricky issues still to be resolved, and no peace agreement is ever perfect. But it's an agreement that is there that we feel offers the best chance in a long while for moving South Sudan in the right direction. So while we are very mindful of the problems that we might experience, we are cautiously optimistic that both sides are committed to going down that path. And if that happens, then it'll make an enormous change to South Sudan.
Joe, and then we'll give the last question to James.
Joseph Klein, Canada Free Press. Could you describe in some detail, if you could, the current state of security for civilians, both in the camps administered by the UN and also elsewhere? Perhaps if you have any numbers of casualties in the last 1 to 2 months, civilian casualties, and who would have been responsible if that were determined for those civilian casualties? Thank you.
In terms of, as I say, the last 4 months since the signing of the agreement, there's been a very significant decline in civilian casualties as a result of political violence. There has been an uptick in the amount of casualties with regard to cattle rustling, raiding, that sort of thing. It would be in the low hundreds, I would say, in terms of that type of activity. But in terms of the actual violence against civilians, that has diminished significantly. We get and I can't give you exact numbers, but we get reports in the south of South Sudan and the Equatorias where there's still a bit of there's still some fighting going on, of casualties happening. It's in the sort of the twos and threes, and not in the in the in the tens or hundreds.
Okay, just to clarify, though, in those cases where UN peacekeepers are present, has that security situation, which was quite bad, you know, a number of months or years ago,
yes,
has that really basically diminished almost to the point of non-existent at this point, where the peacekeepers exert some measure of responsibility for security of civilians?
Yes, there's very low numbers in the POCs. It's virtually nothing. If there's anything, it'll be criminal rather than anything else. And throughout the rest of the country, the peace agreement and the ceasefire has largely held, and so we've seen a. And that's where we patrol. We have not seen any evidence of large-scale abuses. There has been some clashes, but particularly in the last two or three months, it's dropped off significantly.
James, and then we'll go. A quick follow-up to Carol's question on the return of Riek Machar. Obviously, his return last time, in many ways, was the flashpoint. He was accompanied by a very large bodyguard force. Have you thought about how it might happen this time? I heard discussions at one stage that maybe he might be protected by some third-party force, some international force. When he returns in May, have you thought about how that would work? And so that's the follow-up. And one last additional question, because you've given us a very good overview of the political and security situation. I thought maybe you would like to just tell us what the humanitarian yes. situation is.
On the return of Riek Machar, there hasn't been any anything decided on that. But as part of the peace agreement, there is a combined committee called what we call the MPTC, which is the pre-transitional committee, and that brings together the various parties, and they decide on the security arrangements for what happens on the ground. From the UN's point of view, we haven't been approached. We believe that it's in the best interest of the peace agreement that the parties themselves decide how they want to handle those those security arrangements. If they can handle them themselves, that is an enormous confidence step to being able to get things moving. That does not involve the UN. I mean, which I think was I think it's positive from that point of view. On the humanitarian situation, it's still very difficult. The humanitarian appeal that went out and was launched just a little while ago was $1.5 billion. It's targeting, they estimate that people in need are about 7 million. They're looking at about 5.8 million as people that they want to try and target the humanitarians. Last year they were very successful in being able to reach people with the amount of money that they received, which is about $1 billion. They got about two-thirds of what they asked for. One thing that we are trying to do, which I think is significant as stability comes to various places, is to move less along the humanitarian line and more what we call sort of self-reliance and resilience. And that's being embraced by a number of donors and a number of the agencies. So it's rather than providing kind of direct handouts of food, it's about how do we support communities to be able to look after themselves. It's a function of the fact that we just cannot afford to keep the humanitarian numbers going in terms of dollar numbers as long as they are at the moment. And secondly, while we have that opportunity, we should be grabbing it with both hands and trying to move it forward in a positive direction.
Great. All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Sorry, Jessica. Yeah, sorry. Your microphone, Jessica, please.
Tell us, please, about the reports of sexual assaults carried out by the South Sudanese Army.
There was a case just before. Gender-based violence has been a real and recurring problem in South Sudan, right across South Sudan, by all parties. There was a case right just before Christmas in which numbers were very high around Benchu. We investigated that. We have a report that's going to come out in about 2 weeks' time. It's currently with the government. We always share our reports with the government before they come out. I will say that it's the numbers are appalling. At the same time as that was happening, we have also done the biggest problem with sexual-based violence is impunity, that people can do it and get away with it. And we have been working with the South Sudanese Ministry of Justice. And currently at the moment we have mobile courts in the same area for people who are caught and are being prosecuted, and if found guilty they're being sentenced. This is the first time this has happened. It's happened over the last 6 months. We've been very encouraged by the degree of willingness that the government have had in terms of working with us on it. So we've flown judges and prosecutors into these places, and they've been able to hear these people and try them. One of my colleagues who was up there just a little while ago was at the pre-trial, said there were a queue of 49 women standing outside waiting to go inside to give evidence in these trials. There is a real appetite by women in these areas to stop the impunity that's continuing and to move on. And I think it's something that we will be advancing and expanding on in the coming months.
Yeah, can I just ask a follow-up on that? So if you run the numbers by the government in terms of sexual violence, how much do they try to quash the information or play it down, or how much do they argue with you over the numbers? Thanks.
We haven't, on our numbers, we haven't spoken to them about it. I think most would acknowledge that there is a problem. The actual numbers themselves are always open to dispute. We had a number of investigators in there who are very experienced in dealing with us for about a month. So we didn't try and replicate the reports, the earlier reports. We did our own investigation. I can't really go into the numbers now until that report has come out. But we have an ongoing discussion with the government about our concerns about sexual-based violence. There's some pushback, but as I say, there's also some encouraging signs from the Ministry of Justice that they want to move on this and end the culture of impunity that's been so pervasive.
Right. Thank you very much, David. Appreciate it.
Cheers.